Good morning, everyone. Hopefully you realise you're here to hear about flood and hard to insure flood risks and possible funding solutions. This is the third paper that the Flood Working Party, which is the working party of the General Insurance Practice Committee, has put together. The first two papers were presented at the GI seminar last year, and David and Stephen are going to talk to this third paper. Just a bit of background for you. David's the Deputy Managing Director of KPMG Actuaries. He's been working in the Australian insurance industry for the past 20 years, most of that time in general insurance. His experience includes being a general manager of a product and pricing at a major general insurer. I think we all know who that was. And he's very passionate about the need for adequate quantification and pricing of all general insurance perils, and at the same time being firmly of the belief that the product offering has to be commercially palatable both to insurers and to customers, and flood is certainly one of those perils. David qualified as a fellow back in 1994. Stephen is a manager of the commercial lines research in Allianz, Australia. He's a graduate of the University of California in Santa Barbara, where he got a bachelor's degree both business economics and stats. In 97, he began his career at Fineman's Fund Insurance Company, which is a member of the Allianz Group, based near San Francisco. He spent most of his career in various pricing roles around the Allianz Group, both in personal and commercial lines. In 2002, he rotated to Allianz SAC Group in Munich, Germany, where he worked for 2 years as the personal lines actuary. In 2004, he returned to the Fireman's Fund for 4 years in commercial pricing. In 2008, moved out here, and obviously loves it out here, don't you, Stephen? Nodding yes. And he became a fellow of the CAS in 2004 and a member of the American Academy of Actuaries in 2002. So, David, you're starting off, so welcome, David, to the microphone.
Thanks, Daniel. Okay, well, actually, three of us did prepare this presentation today, but unfortunately, Lucy Simpson is interstate, so she sends her apologies. Just in terms of what we're going to do, just a couple of comments that I think Daniel's pretty much already covered about who the Flood Working Party are. Then we're just going to briefly recap a couple of issues from the first paper that the party produced. So, what do we actually mean when we're talking about flood in a property insurance context, and also roughly what flood costs on an annual or expected annual basis? We're going to think about whether the current way in which the flood insurance market works is okay. We're then going to think about some alternatives to that. And finally, we're going to get off the fence that we're sitting on and at least put a possible best alternative out there. So in terms of the Flood Working Party, these are actually the current members. We also have distinguished people who were with us for the first couple of papers, such as Ada Louie. But as Daniel said, it's the third of three papers, and I also want to give special thanks to Ankit Bansal, my colleague, who also put a lot of hard work into this paper, although he's not actually a member of the party. So what do we mean by flood? Well, I guess this guy's got a pretty good idea what he means by flood. Part of the issue with flood is the word is used in a few different ways, and that has different implications for the cover that you have under your property insurance. So you've got flash flooding, which is basically, in essence, water running down a hill very quickly, and that's typically covered under your property insurance cover. Then you've got riverine flooding, and that's, again, in a one-sentence definition, water rising out of the bed of a river or creek or natural waterway and bursting the banks and then causing damage. That's often covered for large commercial property insurance. There's some coverage elsewhere, but the coverage elsewhere in the market is patchy, so for domestic and SME property insurance, the coverage is less, is not universal, unlike for large commercial. Then you've got storm surge. So that's essentially where a storm causes the sea to come in and do water damage. Today we want to talk about riverine flood, And that can be difficult to distinguish from flash flooding. And part of the reason for that is that a lot of the flood damage in Australia is caused by fast-moving, relatively short rivers up the east coast of Australia. And so you can often have a situation where it's not entirely clear which you are actually talking about, whether it's water rising out of the river or simply water running down the side of the hill into the river. So one of the things we did in our first paper was we tried to have a look at an indicative industry-wide cost. I'm just going to recap that very quickly now. So the first observation to make is that if you look at the left-hand bars here, those two bars there, they relate to people who are at the extreme locations, the places where you are likely to get flooded by riverine flooding quite frequently. So the tallest bar by far is these people who are in locations that we expect to be flooded once in every 20 years or more frequently than that. And then the next bar is risks that are located between, say, a 1 in 20 expected flooding and a 1 in 50 year expected flooding. All of the action actually occurs with riverine flooding in those high risk locations. That actually makes sense if you think about what riverine flooding is. If you're close to the riverbank, you're likely to get flooded quite often. If you live on top of a mountain, you're never going to get flooded by a river. That is the reality. So in that first paper, which we did for the General Insurance Seminar in November, we estimated that the extra annual cost of riverine flood, or the extra annual insurance cost, if it were to be fully covered, might actually be of the order of $500 million a year. Probably about two-thirds of that in home insurance and about one-third in commercial property insurance. That's, as you can see, actually $600 million a year, less the roughly $100 million a year that insurers actually, in practice, already pay. I guess we then had a reality check, and I was probably leading the charge at the time on this because I didn't quite believe that $500 million figure when we first came up with it. And part of the reason I didn't believe it and some other members of our working party didn't believe it was we just kind of thought that didn't really seem to sit very well with what we'd seen over the past few years in terms of flood losses or flood losses not being paid in our market and the amount of noise that would be out there in the community from people whose flood claims had not been paid. But one of the key things to note is that Australia pretty much did have a drought, and certainly the eastern side of Australia did pretty much have a drought during the first half of this decade. So the amount of noise and the amount of claims generally over the past few years, particularly that period 2000 to 2005, isn't necessarily indicative of the long-running cost. We don't really want to get too bogged down on this today. It's just background. And the other key piece of background, and again this goes back to the observation I made a minute ago, is that all the action is concentrated into a very small proportion of Australia's property risks. So 94% of risks effectively have no expected riverine flood cost. Then you've got 4% of so-called low flood risks, where you're looking at an average cost, insurance claim cost, of something like $60 a year. But then the last 2%, or the worst 2%, you're looking at about $2,000 a year per risk, according to an insurance council study from 3 or 4 years ago. So this is a serious business, but only for quite a small proportion of the community. I guess that then gets onto the point of this paper, which is the current system of flood cover okay? Well, being an actuary, I thought I'd start with the problems. That's part of the actuarial personality. So, and there are problems. I'm sure there are lots of people who think they're covered against flood but actually aren't. How many people read their home insurance policy in PDS? We've got the issue that I've already referred to about flood events being ambiguous as to their classification. Flash flood and riverine flood can look quite similar to each other, and of course many events have a bit of both. And unless you want to have a war of hydrologists at claim time, it's not particularly feasible to disentangle one from the other. And so as a consequence of those two points, when you have a large flood event, An example fairly close to home is the Hunter event on the Queen's Birthday weekend in 2007. There can be some confusion about what is covered and what isn't. And so you have the potential for a massive flood event, and I think we're probably talking a really massive flood event, larger than that one that I just referred to put a strain on the current system and also potentially to put a strain on reinsurance recoverability. If you're a cedent who said we don't cover flood, and then you want to go and pay a whole lot of ex gratia claims, that might lead to some exciting discussions with the reinsurers, at least in theory, even though in practice it's probably fair to say that hasn't been a big issue so far in this market. There have been various attempts to provide an all-embracing solution that would effectively bring all domestic property insurance into a situation where it offered flood cover, and they really haven't succeeded so far. But let's look at the plus side. The plus side is there is choice, and that choice has actually come about in the last few years. So even as recently as the past 12 months, we've gone to a situation where most of the Suncorp group of companies, with the notable exception of AAMI, but most of their other brands now do offer full flood cover. And they're the second largest general insurance group in Australia. So the fact that that's happened in the last 12 months seems to indicate that things are moving in a direction of more people offering cover. I suppose I should put in some FSRA disclaimer at this point about reading your PDS and policy. But anyway, you can look it up for yourself. It's pretty easy to find direct insurers' PDSs on the internet. Today we only want to talk about domestic risks. That's basically to keep it simple, and also because we figure if you solve it for domestic property insurance, probably the issue will pretty much solve itself along similar lines for SME. So what are the possible solutions? I'm going to talk about the first of these, and then I'm going to hand over to Stephen, who's going to talk about the other three. The first option we looked at to solve this problem was simply just let the market do it, which is pretty unfashionable now, much less fashionable than 2 years ago as a general concept, but maybe it'll work in this case. So what's the current state? As I said, there is a variety of coverage currently available. Some underwriters clearly provide cover for riverine flood. There's no doubt about it. Some underwriters clearly exclude it. They're probably still the majority of customers are on this basis. There isn't a market standard wording, but so what? Most perils don't have a market standard wording. Does that really matter? The anecdotal evidence, not validated by us in any scientific way, is that some insurers who do provide flood cover do so at prohibitive prices in highly flood-prone areas. So essentially, in the current market, you can do that and simply push the insureds who live in those areas to other insurance companies who don't cover flood. And of course, as I've already alluded to, in practice, where you have a flood event that's of dubious classification, ex gratia payments are often made. We're not setting a precedent, but we're keeping the customer happy. And as long as the reinsurer is willing to do their bit, it all kind of works. So how could this evolve to a more all-embracing solution? Well, frankly, we could be heading for a situation in which most insureds who wish to be covered for flood can be so covered. As I said, most of the Suncorp groups move to that basis. You know, there are three other large market players in this market. They're obviously aware of the issue. I have no inside knowledge about what any of them are planning to do, but it's not inconceivable that one or more of them could move in a similar direction. I guess the issue there, though, is price may still be prohibitive for people in certain high flood-prone risk areas. Nevertheless, the question is, would there still be a problem? We kind of tend to think there would still be a bit of a problem. Firstly, there could still be potential confusion after a flood event if some people are formally covered and others aren't. And I suppose we'd also make the observation that the aftermath of a major flood could actually be the worst time to try and solve such a problem. Okay, now I'm going to hand over to Stephen, who's going to take us through another three possibilities.
Okay, thanks, Dave. So I'm going to look at three alternative solutions we looked at. We actually looked at several more, but we're focusing on the ones that are from countries that we think are most culturally similar to Australia and therefore most likely to be implemented successfully in Australia. So this is the history of flood in the UK. I'll just go ahead and put all these points up here for you and highlight a couple in particular. One is that in 1961, a gentleman's agreement was reached between the Association of British Insurers and the UK government. And this basically handshake agreement was to say that the industry would cover flood if the government would do its part for flood mitigation. Now, at first, this was fairly simple. It was just a matter of surcharging policies a little bit. But as sophistication grew in pricing, as more events occurred, as some large events occurred, making matters worse, the UK government wasn't necessarily holding up its end of the bargain. So it's been increasingly under fire, the agreement. It's been in place now almost 50 years, and it's still around. But at the same time, there's always that risk that it can come, that it can unwind. In 2003, the Association of British Insurers established the Statement of Principles, clarifying the industry's position on the matter. And here is what the statement currently says. I'll just go over again a few highlights. So it has three definitions of categories of insurance provision: low, moderate, and significant. Now, the significant is where the concern is. It's the 1 in 75-year events. The low and moderate are covered as normal, but the significant, their position currently is that they're willing to cover significant risks as long as there are flood mitigation in at least planned. They will go ahead and continue to cover. When they're not planned, they will work on a case-by-case basis to try to see if they can reach an agreement with the insured. In fact, in many cases they do, even though they don't guarantee cover. They don't have to cover these people, but they usually find a solution to it. So some of the advantages of the UK system, if we were to implement here in Australia, is it is a market-driven solution. It's one step further from what we're currently doing. It's really a matter of the industry and government having a dialogue and coming to a solution. Also, actuarial rates are predominantly charged, but they're generally affordable to the customers in the UK. UK also enjoys a very high penetration rate of house insurance and therefore flood insurance. And it is a seamless customer experience as being part of the primary policy. There's no confusion on the part of the policyholder. So some of the disadvantages, it's dependent on this gentleman's agreement. Now, certainly in Australia, we wouldn't just say, let's just shake hands with the government and problem solved. What we would intend to do is, you know, a lot more dialogue, perhaps some legal changes, some more firm commitments on both sides would be made. But we still see as a potential difficulty of that is when the long term, you know, when we come forward to the long term, there's no guarantee that both sides will continue to live up to the agreement in the same spirit they had when they made it in the first place. The British Statement of Principles outlines a few concerns that it has about the government commitment. Low flood dispense spending in general. They also want upgraded drainage system. They want to avoid development that's occurring behind existing defenses. This is occurring in the UK because of the pressures on land. It's a lot of population and not a lot of land, so they're having increasing issues with that. And there's also the need for a development of a national database on flood defense. There's also potential issues of access to the global reinsurance market. And Dave alluded to that even in Australia, reinsurers are generally covering flood today, even though they could arguably not do that. In the UK, they are covering that, but the concern here is if you did have a major event and they started to think twice about that, they could basically pull their cover back, and then that would really inhibit the primary insurer's ability to cover flood. And given the global nature of the reinsurance market, that doesn't have to take place in the UK. It could really be a world somewhere else in the world that where the reinsurers lose a lot of money and really think twice about whether this is an insurable peril. So let's talk more about U.S. FEMA now. So how does FEMA work? Well, first, it's a government program. It was established in 1967, the National Flood Insurance Program. Participation, it covers all conceivable types of flood, first of all. Participation is at a community level. So what happens here is that the FEMA works directly with local government to get them to commit to certain measures, such as building flood defenses, avoiding construction of flood-prone areas, and building code upgrades for flood defense. Now, when that is done successfully, then FEMA policies are offered through the private industry to the residents of that community so that they're now able to purchase FEMA insurance. It's administered through private companies. They also handle the claims as well on behalf of FEMA. The FEMA program is required for high-risk insureds greater than one in 100-year events. In fact, in the U.S., you can't receive a mortgage without without having secured cover if you're in a high-risk area. So the mortgage market is aware of that as well. FEMA terms and conditions are separate and generally more restrictive than what the private industry would normally offer. Actuarial rates are charged. They have a few subsidies in place. And there's actually mainly for older buildings. It's actually not so much a high-risk issue. It's actually more that when they put the program in place, they didn't want to discourage people from taking on FEMA insurance by having prohibitively high rates. So they agreed that if a building was already in existence, they didn't want to penalize that, so they gave them a little bit of a break. Because of the average lifespan of a building, there's still several of those remaining. The program has never been capitalized. It has borrowing power. Now, what that means is that in bad years, when there's worse than average results, they actually borrow money from the Treasury. In good years, they then pay that money back plus interest. Okay, well, we did have a significant stress test with Hurricane Katrina back in 2005. That hit the city of New Orleans. Now, the city is mostly below sea level, protected by levees that shield against the Gulf of Mexico. When the storm surge kicked up, it broke through those levees, flooding 80% of the city. Most of those people did not have flood coverage. The reason for that is that they were considered less frequent than one in a 100-year event. FEMA's flood maps had assumed that pricing would, those levees would hold, and therefore they were not in mandatory areas. Needless to say, that became a concern when the levees did not hold. Also in the U.S., we see less often than we do in Australia those ex gratia payments. There were several court cases as a result where the industry was basically asked to pay. But in most cases, the industry held up and those payments weren't made. So claimants were typically compensated for hurricane damage, but not for flood damage. Being such a high-profile event, it was heavily criticized by the media and consumer groups. And in the end, they paid out $17 billion in claims just from this one event alone. To put that in perspective, they collect $2 billion a year in nationwide premium. So needless to say, this borrowing power they have, they are still in debt roughly the amount that Katrina lost them even in 2009. They haven't been able to pay much of that back. So if we implemented FEMA in Australia, this would be some of the advantages. We'd have a very strong relationship of government at all levels to mitigate flood risk. In fact, in the U.S., they estimate that $1.2 billion is saved annually by measures put into place by FEMA to date. Actuarial rates are predominantly charged. And so far, even after Katrina, no capital infusion has been made by the federal government. In fact, until 2005, the program had run almost 40 years and was, in fact, at a zero position at the time when Katrina hit. So until then, they had run successfully by just kind of invoking its borrowing power and paying back from time to time. And that's also a lot of money that, to cover insurance claims, it would have had to come from another source. But because the program was in place, they were getting paid for through policyholder premium. And despite what happened with Katrina, we haven't seen any fundamental changes proposed in the U.S., and as far as I can tell, it's going to be here for the foreseeable future. Some of the disadvantages, it's a significant deviation from the current solution. We're talking about currently a market-driven solution, now moving away from that entirely to a government solution. Penetration rates are low where FEMA is not required. There is definitely a concern about the confusion about flood coverage, as there usually is in these types of situations. Or a lot of people assume that they are covered and are not covered and don't realize they need to buy flood cover through FEMA. The terms and conditions also deviate, which can add to the confusion. And I think the program running at a subsidy kind of assured that in the long run it would have to take a loss. I mean, after 40 years, it was sort of inevitable. We didn't expect it due to Katrina, but it was going to happen anyway. So the last one we want to look at is from right here in Australia. It's the Australian Reinsurance Pool Corporation. And we're borrowing the concept of that to see if we can apply that to flood. Well, what is the ARPC today? It's a terrorism pool. It's written through private companies, and the ARPC effectively acts as a government reinsurer. They charge three levels of rate, 2%, 4%, 12% of premium, depending on the location of the risk. Those high-risk people are those in CBD areas of major Australian capital cities. So there is an industry retained layer, so therefore the insurers are allowed to set their own premium. Typically, that'll be about what the reinsurance charge is, but they can set it at whatever they want. There's also a government exit strategy. They established this in 2003 in response to the terrorism attacks on September 11th, 2001 in the United States. They had envisioned at the time that they would get there was so much panic in the market about terrorism insurance that they would just put this in place for now to keep the market functioning, keep the economy functioning, and then they'd be able to get out of it as the private insurers were able to take on the risk. So far to date, they have been able to raise the industry retention, but they haven't been able to get out yet. In fact, we've seen this the case in the U.S. and the U.K. as well, who have similar programs. So if we did this for flood, what would it look like? Well, first of all, no exit strategy. It's an ongoing peril. Second of all, the focus would be personal risks. It's commercial risk today with the terrorism pool. Cross-subsidies would likely exist. So this is our opinion that if the government put such a program in place, they would likely want to subsidize those high-risk insureds. Now, in doing so, they could either pay for that themselves, or we believe more likely would cross-subsidize by having the low-risk insurance pay into the pool as well. And in order to do that, they would have to make it mandatory for all insured risks. And of course, the government with the ARPC model would begin working work more and more really with communities to reduce flood risks. So some of the advantages: it can be implemented quickly. I think if there was a major flood event, which I think would really have to be the catalyst for anything other than option A, the path we're currently on, then this would be the one solution that we could implement fairly quickly after the event has occurred. All insurers would receive flood coverage, again, if they made it mandatory. Government risk mitigation would exist, and it would also be a seamless experience to the customers. It's essentially reinsurance. So some of the disadvantages, again, a significant deviation, a government solution in place of a market-driven solution. Market forces can be in play. It's a cross-subsidized program that always runs the risk of market forces. So you could have those who don't choosing not to purchase insurance because they're a low-risk flood area. That can conceivably happen. But also with the terrorism pool today, insurers actually technically can choose whether they want to cede risks or not. And in flood, we think they would take advantage of that a lot more if they were given that option. Well, what is the best alternative? I'll turn it back over to David Whittle, who will share that with you.
Okay, so this is where we just get completely opinionated, basically. Obviously, there's no right or wrong answer, but we thought it would be a good idea if we just expressed an opinion. But before we do that, do we need to change? And as we've already mentioned a few times, maybe it's a problem. Maybe this is actually a solution in search of a problem. Maybe there's not really a problem there at all. To the extent there is, maybe it's kind of going to solve itself. I think really where we're coming from is we're saying if the current system were to fail, what are some of the options out there? And we're kind of trying to put a solution out there ahead of the problem rather than waiting for the problem to occur. It's probably also fair to say that when this working party was conceived 12 to 18 months ago, less of the market was offering flood cover, and therefore arguably there was more of a problem at that time. So again, being typical actuaries, we came up with a huge list of criteria and evaluated each of the solutions against those criteria. This is all in the paper, and as time's relatively short, I'm not going to dwell on this slide now. I would encourage you to look it up in the paper, though. You'll probably disagree with some of our rankings. Like all rankings done by committee, there are probably issues in any number of places, but we did kind of feel this was a good way to try to bring some objectivity into coming up with a solution. Today I really just want to talk about some key points of comparison. That also has the advantage of being a slide you can probably read, unlike the previous one. So just these four points of comparison. Firstly, equity of price. In an ideal, actuarially driven world, the price would actually have some fairly good correlation with the amount of underlying risk. And we kind of felt that maybe market forces would get you there, maybe it wouldn't. We kind of felt both the UK and the US approach are reasonable in that regard currently. We kind of felt that an ARPC pull type approach probably wouldn't be all that fantastic in that regard. It would not be terrible, but wouldn't necessarily be fantastic. You would be looking at cross subsidies between all sorts of different people to kind of make the rates sit at a commercially palatable level. I guess the second key criterion we had on our radar was reducing and mitigating the cost and risk of flood. Ultimately, a big part of what this ought to be about is both stopping people putting buildings in stupid places, and also where that's already occurred, putting the flood defences in to at least mitigate the risk of that. And to be honest, an insurance market driven solution probably won't, in our view, achieve that. Probably any solution where the government gets pretty hands on and in some sense has its own money, or in the case of the UK solution, has, you know, public opinion at stake, is much more likely to see that sort of activity take place than one in which the insurance market simply acts. I guess another key point of comparison is sustainability. These numbers were all sort of debated long and hard. Arguably, the current solution is fine, as we've already alluded to. It's really fine until there's a problem. But we did probably feel that a US approach, which after all in the US has survived Hurricane Katrina, or potentially an ARPC-style approach, might actually be more sustainable in the wake of a really major epochal flood event. And finally, ease and cost of startup. Any solution you come up with has to actually be able to be made work in the Australian context. Clearly, the market forces one is brilliant in that regard. It's just whatever's going to happen. We felt that both a UK and a US style approach would in practice encounter significant difficulties in startup in this environment, probably for different reasons. The UK approach might have worked great in England 50 years ago. In Australia in 2009, as Stephen already referred to, people kind of want things written down and it would probably struggle to get up for that reason. The US type approach is fairly cooperative across, certainly in a major way, across two tiers of government, federal and local government. And again, that level of cooperation might be hard to achieve. We did feel that an ARPC style approach was probably a bit more doable than those. Acknowledging that flood would be a much more complex beast, I think, to introduce this for than terrorism was, but nevertheless, it has already been done in the case of terrorism. So we actually came up with something like the ARPC as our preferred solution. And if I just take you back to that slide, you can see it works worst on sort of equity of price, which is the most actuarial criterion there. But frankly, this isn't really an actuarial problem. And although that's a nice to have, it's possibly not a have to have compared to some of those other criteria. So we were kind of seeing this working as cover provided by way of a standard inclusion, flood coverage being mandatory for householders' policies, premium levied as a percentage of the underlying premium, which allows you then to take into account other issues, notably the sum insured and the excess. Cover from the pool provided on a cat excess of loss basis, and a retention applied on an industry level. The government being able to back fund the shortfall in the central fund or central pool that you would need to set up. And the government probably declaring that an event is covered by this, which again is an idea that we shamelessly stole from the ARPC. Well, the advantages of doing that is that you can have some loading of premiums for riskiness, but you can still cross-subsidise the most risky locations. You can get some premium out of the people who live on the tops of mountains, or more to the point, who just live in ordinary everyday places in the suburbs where there's very little flood risk, riverine flood risk. It does provide government with a major incentive to mitigate or reduce risk. Nothing speaks to governments like money or the risk of losing money. But it also provides the government with some cash up front, which again goes to my previous point. And one of the things that a government can do, but an insurance company, of course, can't do, is post-fund a loss. I suppose a key disadvantage is lack of universality. Just as we'll be seeing today in the Royal Commission in Victoria into the bushfires, it's unpalatable to have a scenario in which some people aren't insured. This solution doesn't solve that, but then I don't think you can solve every problem at once. That's really it from us. We've got a few minutes for questions and comments, so over to you guys.
Elaine Collins from Deloitte. Thank you for that presentation. That was really interesting to see the progress that's being made, and interesting to hear that after all the investigation that you did, David, your one comment was it's not necessarily broken. So that's an interesting point to get to. I'm interested in your expanding a bit on the US solution, because I know it was option C there, I think, and it received quite a high score. I think I was trying to add the scores in my head, but I think it was a slightly higher score than option D. I also thought option D was preferable. But the US solution obviously costs a bomb. I mean, I think you said it had been in place for 30 years or something, and it was really at the $0 point when Hurricane Katrina hit, and now it owes the government a huge amount of money. So I would have thought that because of that, it would actually have received a lower score from you. So I'm interested in your thoughts.
Yeah, I guess I can try to respond to that. I mean, I guess as far as, Hurricane Katrina, you know, I guess in our debate, it's sort of a matter of, like, what I guess should have happened in a way. Because certainly, I think Hurricane Katrina could have been handled better by a lot of agencies, for that matter, and sort of, like, had they worked the way they were supposed to, that probably would have been justified, what we were getting to, sort of, you know, with that recommendation. You know, assuming but more competency, so to speak, than that was actually practiced at the time.
Can I add too? We did jokingly contemplate the idea of just adding up the scores and giving it to the one with the highest number, but we decided even we weren't that actuarial.
Nathan Rivett, IAG. David, right at the end you touched on what's been in my mind all the way through this presentation, which was the aftermath of the bushfires in Victoria and what that tells us about the government's motivation to actually want to do anything about this sort of thing. And the biggest problem seems to me to be the uninsured rather than insured. And this addresses the problem of the insured. But I don't know what appetite the Australian population as one entity, as well as the government as a separate entity, has for fixing this problem for the subset of the population that's actually insured, when there's probably, I don't know what your take is on people's opinions as they've emerged with regard to the bushfires and what collective opinion is about insurance generally in those sorts of disasters and how that would be translated into the flood issue.
Look, I think that's a valid point, Nathan. I certainly think people who aren't insured in concept are a bigger problem than people who are insured but just not for one peril. Having said that, it does seem anomalous that you can go to the trouble of... Well, I'll put it another way. It does seem to be the right thing to do for the insurance industry and people like us who are interested in the insurance industry to at least try to make sure that the coverage of those who actually are insured is, you know, the best that it can possibly be. On the Royal Commission, it's certainly going to be interesting to see what comes out of that in relation to insurance. I have no feel for whether insurance will make the cut as an issue that's on the very important list to be addressed this year, as opposed to then, you know, there's a whole list of issues that he'll then address in the full report that he does by mid next year. But presumably at some stage in the 18 months we're going to have some recommendations in relation to insurance and